Today is Monday, April 29th, 2024, and you're listening to the Ask a Christian podcast. I'm your host, Nate. All right, today we burned through a bunch of topics here. They're good. It's great. Happy Monday. All right, no case of the Mondays here. 1 Timothy chapter 6. It's what I read this morning when I first woke up and opened my eyes, and I thought this would be great to start out the podcast. So we go through some of the wisdom in 1 Timothy chapter 6 about quarreling and people who exchange, you know, what they call knowledge, and it's really not. Anyway, and that ends up leading people away from the faith. Listen to that. So we go through that. And then for all the people that are like, no, Satanists aren't real. Like, they don't really believe in an actual Satan. They just do it to blah, blah, blah and be edgy and cool. Well, tell that to the satanic ritual people who just got arrested for sacrificing a girl to the beast because it needed souls. So, you know, tell that to them. Okay, anyway, then we talk about Christy Noem's controversy of her dead dog that she shot because apparently it liked killing too much. Then we delve into some computer nerd talk quickly, and then we talk about my friend's painting dispute with a girl he was dating and who gets custody of the painting, and then we get into dating apps and how do Christians date today, because apparently dating is just so insane today. How is one supposed to do it? All right, these topics and more, and then we get into near-death experiences, but not so much as last time. It's more like biology and how can the body survive. That's kind of where we go. So anyway, share these links. We'll see you all later.
I thought I'd start the day with trying to read some Bible in here. I don't know. You'll see where this is going in a minute, but I don't think there's anyone currently here whose feathers it will ruffle, even though maybe it should ruffle all of ours a little bit. But I don't know. Think of what we know of Clubhouse and then the Bible. So I was reading this morning when I woke up, and I'm like, I need to remember that. That's a great start to the day. That's not going to get me disliked by anyone. Okay, so there's a couple parts in, I was finishing 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy 6. Okay, there's two parts here. I think there was three, but I can't remember it, or I can't find it. Okay, so let's see. Good morning, CEO, by the way. 1 Timothy 6, verse 3. If anyone teaches a different doctrine and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ, see, not us, Jesus, and the teachings that accord with godliness, he is puffed up with conceit and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words, which produce envy, dissension, slander, evil, suspicions, a constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. And then it goes on from there talking about, you know, just don't strive for money. It's worthless. Be happy with what you have. Be content. And then the other part, let's see. 20, verse 20. Oh, Timothy, guard the deposit entrusted to you. Avoid the irrelevant babble and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. For by professing it, some have swerved from the faith. Wow. Okay. Who has thoughts on that? That are not related to Clubhouse in totally any way at all.
I think it's so funny because I read that same passage this weekend. they were making a comparison about it being Paul's swan song versus Peter's swan song, because Peter does something very similar.
I don't know. On one hand, it's like, well, you know, look at all the fighting Christians, and like tie that to them and make them read that 20 times a day. Oh my gosh, his ears were burning. and also the other one, it's like, look how many atheists are like, oh, I'm so enlightened now. Like, I don't believe in fairy tales anymore. It's like, really? Are you calling? And then the stuff they call like knowledge, right? And it's just like empty, just blah. It's nothing. What's up, CEO?
If you have to quarrel or fight with someone about the word and about the Bible, then you both are doing something wrong. You're not reading it right.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's discussions and then there's like ridiculous arguing. But Nate, I was going to ask you if you heard about the puppy killer this weekend.
No. Tell me about your puppy killer, and I'll tell you about how people are like, no one really sacrifices anyone to Satan. That's Christian fiction. That's a myth. While two gang members were arrested specifically for, like, raping and sacrificing, their words, a 14-year-old and would have been a 15- and 16-year-old to the image of a beast in their closet because they needed to give it souls. So you tell me about your puppy, and I'll tell you how about that.
I think we should start with yours because it sounds graver.
So this was MS-13
gang. This is an uplifting morning you got going on here, Nate.
Oh, watch the replay. See the beginning before you got here. These are some of all of God's children, right? Because Nancy Pelosi told us the MS-13 illegal gang members are God's children. And, you know, he created them, but that doesn't mean they're his children. There's a specific, it was like a local ABC station or whatever I read the article on, and it said they were caught with like a 14, 15, and 16-year-old girl kidnapped, tied up in these people's basement. I think it was in New York somewhere, of course. And that already like raped the 14-year-old and killed either her or the 15-year-old. But when asked, like, they didn't say something normal, no. The cops said they found the image of some like satanic looking beast statue in their house. And when asked about it, they said they had to kill the girl because they had to feed souls to the beast. So, anyways, where are the atheists when you got to say, no, Satanists don't really believe in a real, a real Satan. They just do it to be edgy. Tell that to the murdered dead person that was sacrificed for the beast. Anyway.
Do you want to, on that note, do you want to hear my sassy hot take for today on this subject?
Satan? Sure.
Yeah, so the conquistadors of Spain were doing God's work by wiping out the Aztecs.
Oh, because they were Satanists.
The genocide of the Aztecs was a good and righteous thing. Yeah, there you go.
CEO, what about your puppy story? Does it meet satanic rituals?
Yeah, so the South Dakota governor, Kristi Noem, biography. Yeah, that she had a 14-month-old puppy and was training the puppy to be a hunting dog. And they went out one time and the puppy showed too much happiness afterwards, so she decided to kill the puppy. You know, not train it further or be more patient with it, but to kill it and then decide, and then says leaders have to make tough decisions.
It was because it was like a violent dog, right? Like I just read the headline.
No, it was because the puppy was too
happy.
It was too happy about killing something.
Oh, okay. So the headline I saw, maybe it was calling her vicious and violent. Okay, yeah, so, I mean, I just perused the headline, but I'm like, what, am I going to read about, you know, a killed dog or, you know, something like Satan rituals? I don't know. So I guess I skipped the dog one too much. But, yeah, okay, so the headline I thought said everyone was mad at her because the hunting dog was, like, too vicious and was, like, going after people, and she basically had to put it down. And I'm like, well, how is that bad? But now that you say that, I guess the headline was probably talking about her being violent vicious. So yeah, that's messed up, man. Like the tough choice for a leader for having too happy of hunting dog is give it to your kid. Give it to a family friend who wants a happy dog.
It was happy, not happy like excited like a cute dog. It was happy that it was killing stuff. It was that was the problem.
So the first thing is true. It was a like crazy dog that was happy to kill things, right? Oh, you people.
Correct. Yes.
That's what I said. It was happy about killing things. That's why she killed it.
So why was I corrected on the first time when I said it was a crazy, vicious dog?
Because I don't think he was vicious. She just felt like his disposition was too content and happy after he killed something, and she didn't like that.
I mean, if this conversation goes too long, I mean, I may be happy about, you know, muting and blocking everyone.
No, Nate. The thing is, a puppy is often going to be happy about doing whatever you trained it to do, right? Because it's a puppy. So like you said, give it to the pound, you know, but why do you have to go put it in a gravel pit and assassinate it? I mean, that is the part that's strange.
Have you ever been to a farm?
Well, before that,
like
farmer, before
I mean, like farms,
farmer Chris,
like you shoot stuff. Like this happens all the time. Like this is like you live on a farm, you deal with life and death literally every day. You're chopping the heads off of chickens and like all kinds of things that we as modern city folk find really reprehensible. But that's just life on a farm. Like,
yeah, no. This is different than that, Chris. Because
Okay. Well, let's back up before we give farmer. We need to give farmer Chris a conquistador helmet, and that makes a lot of sense now. But okay, so my thoughts still having not. Maybe I should just read this article myself. But based on what you're telling me, okay, so now she has a dog. It's a good hunting dog, but she sees the bloodlust in its eyes and it's happy to rip the life out of prey instead of just being like, I have to kill you for my master, chomp chomp. Now it's happy to cause death. Okay, I get it. So, and I mean, unless it was like, you know, some kind of like Cujo thing where it's like trying to go after her or whatever, and you're like, okay, yeah, this is writing itself. Boom, boom, you're dead dog. I would get that. But assuming it's just very happy, she thinks, to murder things, I think I'd be like, hey, you know, high risk animal shelter. I'm going to give you this dog and let you run it through your little assessment. And if you think it's good or stable or can be rehabilitated or something like that, then you go for it. If it can't, then kill it. That's what I think a reasonable person should have done. How does that sound, CEO? Again, I know less people than anyone.
I agree. That is absolutely a great answer. But the biggest problem I have with it is she then says, leaders make tough decisions, as though this is like some leadership quality we're supposed to say, oh, you need to be president of the United States one day because you killed your puppy.
Do you have a puppy, CEO?
I think there's a little more to that story than what's been articulated. I was just reading the excerpt from it and said the dog not only done that when it was out hunting, it went back to the farm and started killing the chickens and stuff. Now, you can agree or disagree with it. You can agree or disagree with it, how it was handled, and I don't particularly agree with it, but in a lot of rural communities where your livestock is your way of life, this is a common practice that was done for years. If you can't train them, they're killing the farm animals. A lot of farmers would put them down. So, you know, people that's never lived that life or had to depend on their livestock for their subsistence, they can look at it and say, well, they're crude or they're obnoxious in the way they handled it. That could be interpreted that way. But to pretend that this is not something that people that live in these communities that depend on these animals for their survival haven't done through the years is not true.
Right? Well, no, Steve, it just that there's too many things stacked on top of it. So it's a puppy, right? So there's that. But even if you say, all right, I have to kill the puppy, you know, don't say this is the tough decisions that leaders make as though you're supposed to get high praise for it. So she just went too far. It's just ridiculous.
I understand what you're saying, CEO, but I think it was more in the context of this is the reference she was making. When you manage a farm like that, and your survival as far as the farm goes depends on the livestock. And a 14-month-old is not truly a puppy. They're a young adult dog. But when you depend on these things for your survival, any person that has an ounce of any empathy in them would say it's a tough decision to kill an animal for the betterment of the farm. I think that was the context that she was trying to put it in. This is not a decision unless you're a complete psychopath. You take one of your dogs out and just shoot it. No, you're making that decision because the dog can't be trained and it's going to have detriment to your existence. I think that was the point that was being made, CEO.
Okay, so I've read the article already because it's short, so I can't find the quote you're saying, CEO, about good leaders. So I mean, who knows? Maybe she did this so people have to buy her book. Like, I guarantee book sales went up now so they can hear her whole story. But from what I did find by the quick article is apparently this happened 20 years ago. So about a 20-year-old story. So that would be one point. It's a long time. Is there no forgiveness in your heart? Secondly, compared to the amount of evil, psychotic, murderous crap, you know, the other, her opponents do, this is not even recognizable. I mean, she's like got angel wings doing this stuff, and probably lots of other dogs, you know, in comparison to the evil crap her opponents do. Let's see. She uses the law to justify it. Doesn't matter. Can't legislate morality. And let's see. It wasn't an easy choice. She acknowledges that. And yeah, I mean, if it was like killing her other farm animals, yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I mean, I see your point, CEO. I'm not as fervently, but I mean, I'm kind of with Steve. I mean, it just, and again, 20 years ago. So compared to, yeah. So that's my big takeaway, CEO. Yeah, I mean, I like to think if I would have been in that situation, I mean, if it just would have been eating everything in sight, I probably would have killed it too. Because I'm like, okay, clearly there's no rehab. It's killing. It's already killed lots of things that it wasn't supposed to, right? Like my other pets or other farm animals. But if it hadn't done that, if it was just like being aggressive or going after them, or if it had only bitten Chris a few times, I'd be like, okay, well, let's see if there's a high-risk animal shelter around here. I guarantee, like, the dog whisperer could have made that thing like a little lap dog. But
yeah, I mean, there's a possibility that the dog just isn't cut out for farm life, right? So you give it to a shelter, you put it in a nice home in an urban city, and maybe it just does much better, right? My biggest issue is that, yeah, it was 20 years ago, Nate, but she decided to write it in her memoir that just came out. So she is bringing it up and bragging about it. She didn't get asked about this in some interview. She wrote about it and sees it as a leadership quality. And my issue is that in today's America, this is what we decide to call great leadership values. That is my issue.
Well, my thought is, have you read the book? Because if the book, you know, paints it negatively, like, this is a great leadership, it was going after some chickens, and I killed it, and, you know, I loved it and celebrated it. Or if it's like, this was the hardest decision of my life, it was so awful, but I just couldn't have all these dead animals. So, I mean, I think since she wrote a book, we should probably actually read the book, if we care, to get her actual story, and then, judge that.
Are you telling CEO to go read a book? I think you just told CEO to go read a book.
I think I did. Oh, Lord help me, I've become this.
Well, you know, there's one other thing to this, too. Typically, and I think South Dakota would be classified as this, if you're in a rural setting and, you know, you may have a ranch, and I'm not sure what the typical size of the farms or ranches in South Dakota is, but you could be in a spot that is very rural, and you might be looking at 60 to 80 miles to find an animal shelter. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying it's a possibility. And you know, there's other aspect of this too. As farms have become less dependent on survival of these livestock, and I know, you know, I live in a rural area and I've seen this done. And as they become less dependent on these things for their very survival, I think the practice has diminished, but, you know, it's like my grandparents done this exact same thing. I mean, at one point, the only thing they bought to live was sugar and flour. Everything else was raised on the farm. They didn't have to go to Walmart to live or to eat. And they was very, very hawkish on this kind of stuff. I can remember one time my grandmother said, we're going to have chicken today. And she said, go out and get the chicken. And me and my uncle went out, and my uncle, he said, grab that chicken. I did. And he said, lay it there on that block. And I laid it down on the block, and he chopped its head off. And I'm sitting there just freaking out. You know, here's this chicken. They'll sometimes run after their head gets chopped off, you know. But for people that's never lived that and seen that, you can say, well, my God, a small kid out there watching his uncle chop a chicken's head off is horrific. But that was life back then. That was how farmers did things. Now, you can say that's right or wrong, but that we're talking about people that had to survive and didn't have Walmart five minutes down the street.
Well, I hear that, and when I write my memoirs, I'm going to put in a story that's going to make CEO just have night terrors. So my mother tells me a story about how, you know, she grew up in, like, rural Oklahoma. And her dad, my grandpa, they would have, you know, wild dogs, or whenever their dog got pregnant or whatever. He would always let, like, my mom and her sister, like, you know, pick out a dog out of a whole litter where there'd be, like, six or eight. So they'd pick out, like, you know, one each. That's, like two dogs. And then he'd put the rest, like, in a big sack and go start his truck and hold it up so the carbon monoxide would kill them. So there you go, CEO.
Well, this is like the 1940s, right? I mean, so I don't judge life through the same filter as I judge the 2000s. She's referencing something that happened in the 2000s, so that's the first issue.
To answer your question, this would be the 60s, I believe.
Okay, but fine. I still want to judge the 60s the same as the 2000s. And Steve, lastly, if Christy Noem ever offers to pay me like $50,000 to do PR for her, you get to be the spokesperson. You get to be the spokesperson, Steve, because you've done a wonderful job.
Well, I'm just trying to explain the mindset that this wasn't considered as nefarious as the, you know, as it's being painted. And there is a decision-making aspect to it, because the decision-making aspect and the leadership is, are we going to eat tomorrow or not? And what are we willing to do to keep this thing in line? And it's not as clear for people that's never lived that life and understand what goes into it. It can be misconstrued, and I'm not trying to say yay or nay, and I'm trying to say that type of stuff, as they become less dependent for survival, has dissipated. So it was a survival thing.
And that's the kind of the point of, like, understanding each other better, right? Because that's why we, like, accuse our politicians of being out of touch with the common people they represent, because, you know, they've been in, like, Washington or in power so long that they're kind of, like, in a different level. And it's like, no, inflation's a good thing. It's like, how are you saying that? And it's like, oh, well, because of XYZ. It's like, no one cares. You're so out of touch. So it's like a bunch of, like, city reporters trying to, like, you know, critique, you know, someone 20 years ago in the Wild West. It's like, you just don't understand, like, exactly what you're saying, Steve. But if anything, CEO, answer this. So if that's how it was then and people think that was too rough, what has happened today is we're making our kids into a bunch of jellyfish. Shout out Chris of In Jellyfish, but cultural jellyfish. So these kids today have zero grit and zero stomach. So there's this big incident going on in my community about this guy who tries to act all, like, big and tough. He's like this big, like, trying to be like, I'm a macho man. But he's got two boys who are slightly under teen years, very much slightly under teen years. Anyway, so they got asked to leave the pool because they didn't have, like, ID to show that they belong there or whatever in our community center. So all the guy did was just like, hey, if you don't have ID, you got to leave. Go ahead and leave. You're not here with anyone. Please leave. And apparently the guy at first went ranting all over social media, trying to show how bad it was and how much Nazis everyone was around here and how the pool guard's a terrible person. But he said the quiet part out loud, or what I would have thought the quiet part would have been. So he's like, my boy, just under 13, do the math in case anyone's listening, trying not to, like, you know, be too specific. But just under 13 came home and called him at work crying because the pool guy told him he had to leave because he didn't have an ID. I'm like, dude, I don't care about anything else in the rest of your story. If my 9-year-old girl came home crying because someone told her to leave because she didn't have ID, I would never tell anyone that story. I would be so embarrassed. I'd be like, you do not cry about crap like that. If you're bleeding, if someone dies, if you got a broken bone, cry all the time. I won't judge you. If someone says you broke a rule, you need to leave, do not cry. Anyway, so if you think that life is too rough, what we're doing now is way, way, way overcorrecting. That was my point.
Well, I mean, I guess the great irony in that is we are the Gen Xers who grew up feral and, you know, tough and all this. And these are our kids. So what does that tell you about how we really feel about how we were raised?
Well, it tells me that if you treat your kid like that, then you feel a certain way about how you were raised. But I mean, like, I was like aghast. So I'm taking the complete opposite approach. And I'm like, no, I'm like, my kids will not do that. I mean, proof positive. I'm not perfect. They're not perfect. But I mean, you know, whenever crap like that happens, when they fall down, skin their knee, I'm like, up, 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 get up, get up, get up. Nope. Throw some alcohol on that, get a Band-Aid, go on your way. They're like, I didn't even cry. I'm like, you're amazing. Let's have some ice cream. So like, I hear stories about like all these like jellyfish parents raising jellyfish kids in school. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And they're like, yeah. And you know, this little girl, like, you know, told this other little girl, if she doesn't give her her pencil, then she's not going to be her friend. And she started crying and ran away and wouldn't come out of the bathroom. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like, well, did they ever do that to you? And they're like, someone tried once. And they're like, if you don't give me your pen, I won't be your friend. And she's like, fine, don't be my friend. And she's like, oh, okay. I didn't mean it. We can be friends. I'm like, yes, that's right. Let me reward that behavior. So, I mean, I'm sure there's some people out there, you know, who kind of take my approach, which, you know, some people may think is too hard or rough, but I think it's going to serve them well later in life. I mean, serving them pretty well right now. So yeah. Chris, how about you? Where do you stand?
Cause you're your kid's a monster, about the age. Nate.
Your kid's about the age we're talking about. So, if your child, you know, broke a rule, not a big thing, not a big deal. No one's going to jail. But broke a rule at a pool, and you know, your house is, it's not like he has to go 5 miles home and like get picked up by strangers. Like, this, the person's house is within 50 yards of the pool. So, you know, your child doesn't have an ID. He's like, oh, I don't have my ID. And they're like, oh, well, you have to leave. And he came home. How would you react? Like, if he calls you just bawling and sobbing, like, daddy, I got kicked out. Would you be like, oh, there, and like stroke his head as he like gently,
I mean,
wept?
I would wonder if, or would you be like, else wrong?
Well, let's assume there isn't. Like, the fact is, he didn't have an ID. He got asked to leave. If he calls crying, are you going to be like, there, it's okay? Or be like, buckle up, buttercup?
I don't know. I just can't even imagine my kid crying about something like that. I mean, okay, my kid hasn't cried in years. So
I know. That's what I'm saying, right? It's weird. It's not normal. Like, I would never tell anyone that story.
You know, my parenting style is closer to yours, but all I'm saying is that it is pretty strange that, like, when we look at the kids generationally, though, it is the Gen Xers raising them, and it's odd that this is how Gen Xers are parenting. So, again, what does that say? And I'm talking generic Gen Xer. I'm not talking about you or Chris or I. Generic Gen Xer. What does this say about generic Gen Xer that this is the parenting style?
If there's like data or a study, like that, I'd be interested, because, I mean, you know, it's not a monolith, right? So you could say culturally a lot more that way, but I mean, you know, like I don't know, like, I've got some cousins that they're raising their kids still in rural Oklahoma. I mean, like, it's the 1800s. So there's like, you know, none of that stuff. But then I've got another cousin that completely just bows down to anything his, like, you know, atheist liberal wife, by the way, says, and he's got no backbone. And I am concerned about the outcome of this child. So I mean, it goes both ways, but I think culturally it's more to the soft side.
Yeah, I mean, and I think also we have to recognize that, you know, the silent generation, the one before the baby boomers, who raised a lot of the Gen Xers, were very unhappy with our rock and roll and hip hop music from the 80s and 90s, and thought that we were going to end society as well.
And I mean, this is an interesting study, right? Like, I don't know personally how interested I am, I mean, to get the Cliff Notes, but for people into, like, you know, sociology or whatever, this would be really interesting, because there's so many dynamics there, right? And it's not just like one generation raised them this way and one isn't. It's not a dichotomy. There's lots of nuance. So, for example, I would want to know, because I'm just going to go out and say probably most of the people that, okay, so this group was like strict, didn't like rock and roll, which they considered like Billy Joel and Sock Hop's rock and roll. But by the time we get to, like, you know, Megadeth, Pantera, and Metallica, I'm going to just say probably most of the people that listen to that, like, not just to be cool or posers, but, like, you know, actually really liked that type of music, that type of mentality and lifestyle, they probably didn't raise their kids to be weenies. I think, if anything, you could say they probably raised their kids more neglectful, and just didn't really take an maybe that much of an active parenting role, or maybe they did. I don't know. Maybe they were the cool parents that wanted to be friends with their kids. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, there's a lot to that. And I wonder how thoroughly that's been studied.
Well, you know, one thing that I don't care what generation you come from or what parenting style you have, it's like I've told my kids through the years, there's rules to the road as far as survival and as far as doing decent for yourself. And whether you want to think these rules apply to you or you don't think these rules apply to you, those rules will eventually jump up and slap you in the face and say they do apply to you. And the farther you shield someone from the realities of existence in this world, because it's not always going to be easy. There's going to be hard times. There's going to be things that you're going to struggle with. And the more you shield people from the reality of the rules of the road of existence, the weaker you make them and the more delusional you make them, to the point that they don't know how to deal with tough situations when they occur. I mean, this is one thing that my father always instilled in me. Hey, things aren't always going to be easy. Someone's not always going to stroke your boat. And you need to tighten that belt up and grit your teeth a little bit and go on, because you're going to have these times. And if you're not prepared for them, you're going to suffer. It doesn't matter what generation, it applies to all of us at all times. There's rules to the road. You either acknowledge it or you're delusional and they're going to smack you in the face.
100%. Like my parents' life, parenting model, which I guess I've kind of adopted. The goal is, look, raise your children first to, stay out of hell and stay out of jail, and then just do the best you can. So, you know, we come up from a long line of aiming for the middle. But it's like, all right, look, don't worry about being a doctor or lawyer first. Raise them to stay out of hell and jail, and then just do the best from there. So, woo! I mean, that should be bad, though, right? Because you're like, oh, you're an underachiever. Well, yeah, but this model, at least you have eternal life. So, I mean, you know. And this model, you can also end up being highly successful in a doctor or lawyer.
I just want to say, and Bo, I don't know if it's all of her fault. I think the baby boomers probably were the worst parenting generation. They raised the millennials, and the millennials are in pretty tough shape. And a lot of the stuff that you talk about, the flakiness, et cetera, really came from them. And I think part of the issue with baby boomers is that millennials grew up with the internet and baby boomers didn't know how to navigate it. So Gen X has the advantage of being more tech savvy. So I think, you know, Gen Z kids are more trusting of their parents because, you know, we're more savvy than what the baby boomers were.
That is pretty decent analysis, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, you could say maybe it's not all baby boomers' fault. For the internet reasons, I think there's other reasons besides the internet. But, I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, if it's this new technology and they don't know how to use it and their kids are, like, getting in all kinds of devilment and they're none the wiser, I mean, I guess it's that part can't really be their fault, because it's like, well, you should have known better. How? No one knew better. There was no one to tell us better. And then, like, you know, that people tried to explain it, and we had no idea what they're talking about. So, I mean, yeah.
Well,
I mean,
that's true for a large portion, but I guess I'd be considered a boomer. And in 1984, I wrote my first computer program. I taught myself from scratch without any schooling, just some tech-savvy friends I had. A guy from that was a computer specialist for the Special Warfare Operations Center at Fort Bragg helped me a lot. And, every boomer wasn't like that.
Well, of course not, Steve. Baby boomers created the internet.
But I mean, for the regular run of the mill people that, I mean, you know, it was a new technology. Like, I mean, goodness. Like, I mean, I was on the tail end of that. Like, you know, we had the first internet. I made it all the way to middle school without knowing what a computer was. And then in eighth grade, when we had this whole presentation. It was like you know, the some huge thing was going on, like a rock star was at our school, and it was this person doing a presentation in the library of a computer that had a CD-ROM. Okay, well, let me back up. Okay, so in elementary school, we had like the Apples. We had the Apple computers, like with the orange screens and stuff. Okay, but the first time, yeah, in eighth grade, whenever we got a real computer with like color, and they're like, look at this. This is a CD-ROM. And they like showed us. They're like, you have to like, you know, wear gloves when you put it in and be very careful. And now, you know, then whenever it became a little older, we're just like throwing the CDs around. Like it doesn't matter, and scratching them, and they still work. And but yeah, so.
Well, I can remember when I first started building computers. I think I built my first one from scratch in 1982. It had a 8 megahertz processor. But anyway, a friend of mine that was real tech savvy, he said, hey, Steve, you got to come over here and look at what I got. I went over to his house and he had a 5 megabyte hard drive. That was like the size of a CD player. He said, look at that. I said, oh, man. Because, you know, everyone, the only thing anyone had was like the 1.44 drives. You know, that was like the big thing back then. You know, I got a 1.44 floppy in my hard drive or in my computer. And here's this guy with the, with a 5 meg hard drive, and we're like, oh yeah.
Well, Chris, you were around before computers and electricity. How did you catch up to speed? Now you're like the overlord of it all.
How did I catch up to speed? I never had to catch up to speed. I won the Golden Apple Award in elementary school for programming games with Apple IIs. So.
Yeah. I do remember there's like a math game that we had like on a 5.25 floppy. Is that
yeah.
right?
5.25? Yeah, that's 5 1/4, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And and it was like you had to get these math problems right to make the car go to like the next little spot, and we had to do it on a timer. That was a kind of fun game.
Yeah, I mean,
right, what else we got?
Computers. Like I literally had computers since I was like 8 years old. So like,
oh.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't as advanced as they are today, but like, you know, you had to do a lot more stuff for yourself. So you had to like use logic and figure things out. So like with my son, he can fix computers. The problem is that everything is so easy in the GUI that like, he's just not savvy. Like if I break something down to a command line, he just looks at me like I'm nuts.
Yeah. And yeah.
So
me,
I grew
me
up
too.
With command line.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with command line, but it was like PC command line. It was like super, you know, I mean, the stuff I did was, DOS. The stuff I did was easy. But, you know, now I use Linux. So every time I like run into a problem and I like try to read how to do something, it always is like, bring up a command line. I'm like, no.
Yeah,
so I'm like, how do I do this? How do I do this graphically? Because the command lines, like, there's so many Linux versions, like trying to make sure it gives you the right command line for the right, right.
Without getting nerdy, what distro are you using?
Manjaro.
Is that a Debian?
It's Arch Linux.
Is that a Debian flavor or a Red Hat flavor? Is it RPM or is it like when you install
new packages? Okay. So unless you
correct me, .deb for your packages or is it .rpm?
Bro, I'm telling you, it's neither. It is Arch Linux is its own thing. It's TRZ or TG, whatever the T one is. It's not Debian.
Well, that's not a distro package. That's a tarball.
Okay, then
TGZ
is a
zipped tarball.
Oh, okay, then forget that. But no, it's not Debian. It doesn't work with like, I know like you do Ubuntu is Debian. None of that stuff works with this. It's Arch Linux. So whatever Arch Linux is, that's what I have. I thought Arch Linux was its own thing. I don't think it has anything to do with Red Hat.
Do you guys remember when you built computers years ago, you had to set the interrupts and the DMA channels?
Oh, yeah.
Before you could get the computer to even... And one of the things that used to be bad was the mouse. The interrupts with conflicts on the mouse.
Yep. Yeah, you had all the DIP switches.
Well, Chris, what were you saying? Did you get your answer question about my distro?
I'm just going to look it up. I mean, there's a lot of you're totally correct. There's a lot of distros out there. But, why didn't you want to use Ubuntu? That's the
this is why. One. Yeah, this is why. So I kind of like Arch Linux now that I have got used to it. But okay, so the whole reason, which I beat my head against the table for, while everyone's leaving. Hang on, we'll talk about Jesus in a minute. But whenever I made the switch to Linux, I wanted to use Linux Mint because that was also based on Debian. And I had used it in the past, and it looked pretty, and it was more user-friendly, so I wanted to do that. But the first computer I tried installing it on, it wouldn't work, like my main computer, and I could not figure it out. And finally, after like months of this, like I tried different distributions, and Arch Linux, the Manjaro, was like the only one. I mean, I tried probably 20-plus, and Manjaro was the only one that worked. Well, months later, I found out that it was a problem installing because it just wouldn't install. Like every time it got to a certain part on installing the OS, it would just stop and say failed. I could not figure out why. Eventually, I figured out it had to do with a Wi-Fi card I had replaced at one point a long time ago. And that specific Wi-Fi card had like known issues messed with the OS. So anyway, that's the reason I ended up going with Manjaro, because it worked. But then, I mean, I just got used to it in that time. So by the time I figured out why, like my wife, she has Linux Mint because it was just easier for her. But I really kind of like Arch Linux now. Like they have a bigger repository overall. And yeah,
I got to go, guys. But it was really good talking to CEO. It's good seeing you, man.
Good seeing you.
You guys have a
Take care, Steve.
You guys have a great day. Good conversation. Thanks a lot for allowing me to participate.
Oh, of course. It was great. Thanks for your input.
DMA. So I have direct memory access.
I have a topic change. So Chris, what are your general thoughts on the Presbyterian Church in terms of like the top level leadership and the belief system, et cetera?
Which Presbyterian Church?
Like the Presbyterian Church, as in like the ones who like oversee it officially.
Like I said, there's like seven of those.
Then I don't know how to further describe it. I mean, because
so there's PCUSA, right? It's Presbyterian Church, United States of America. There's PCA, Presbyterian
USA,
Church of America.
United States of America.
That the one. USA? It's
yeah,
not a
Presbyterian Church.
Church,
USA.
PCUSA is not a church. It's a pagan country club.
Yeah. Okay. So figure out a way to translate, Chris. PCUSA is like the liberal branch. It's like Skittles people and, you know, lady bishops and all that stuff. So, Chris, of the seven, which one would you more closely align with? And then what do you think of that leadership?
PCA. And I think it's complicated right now. There's a fight going on in the PCA because people want to, there's a contingent of PCA churches that want to go liberal Skittles, and they're fighting against those people. And so it's a very subtle fight. And it's a very difficult fight. And people are very concerned that the PCA is going to turn.
Well, why can't the people that want it to go Skittles just join the Presbyterian branch that's already gone Skittles?
Because Satan wants to destroy things. He doesn't like churches, so he's trying to destroy things.
Well, but what's these people's actual reason? They probably don't say what you said. So what do these people say? Because it's two Skittles or not?
Because
Skittles?
They want to make the PCA an inclusive organization, and they're part of the PCA. They feel a right to it because they've been PCA for however, you know, it's like started in the 70s. You know, so they're this is our denomination.
Okay, so at one point it was all Presbyterians, right? And then there was like different schisms over the years, and that's why you have PCUSA. And when they say, well, look, mm-hmm. PCUSA is exactly what you want. Why don't you just go there? And they say, because we're not PCUSA, we're PCA, and you need to be inclusive. That's mm-hmm. why.
Yeah, well, okay, that's their excuse. The real excuse is that they're demon-possessed Satan worshippers.
Good morning, Steph.
Oh, I, so sorry. So I have a follow-up then. Okay, so I met with you know, for branding purposes with one of the leaders of, I guess it's the USA one. And he said to me that, well, let me get the language right, that the number seven in Hebrew symbolism represents completion or perfection, and that the number 40 represents testing, trial, preparation, or a long time period. Do you agree or disagree with those statements?
Yeah, those are that's common biblical exegesis.
Okay. Okay, cool. And then so if that is a case and those numbers carry symbolism, why would we take when they're utilized in the Bible as literally being 40 days or 40 years as opposed to saying that it's a long time or it's a, you know, testing and preparation period? Why take the number literally as 40 days or 40 years?
Because the author put down 40 years and meant it as a literal number. It doesn't matter what I think or what you think. It matters what the author thinks. And when we're doing correct hermeneutics and biblical exegesis, it's trying to get to the original intent of the original author and how his audience would have understood that.
Okay, and if his audience were to... sorry, Sam, one second. So... if his audience were to normally use the number 40 as a long time period testing and preparation, isn't that how he would how he would anticipate his audience to receive it?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
So if his audience associates the number 40 with testing and preparation or a long time period, then isn't that how he would expect his audience to receive it?
Well, sure, but why are those things associated with that? It's the cart before the horse, right? So the reason that seven is considered completion and 40 is considered testing is because those time periods are repeated over and over again in the scripture in those contexts. It wasn't that those things meant those things and then they were using fake numbers to, you know, reiterate those things. It was that, you know, the rain lasted actually 40 days, you know, and then we take from that the symbolism. So it's not like there was a symbolic argument.
That 7 and 40, long before the Old Testament was written, weren't associated with those things already. Are you sure of that?
I don't have to be sure of that. Like, I mean, it doesn't matter. Again,
it does matter. If before the Old Testament was written, those are what those numbers were associated with, then what the writer is writing would be from that perspective.
I mean, again, there's no way to know that. When Moses was writing Genesis, he was writing to an audience of Hebrews that had just left Egypt. When language is used that is symbolic, we take it symbolically. When language is used as literal, we take it literally according to whatever the text tells us. It doesn't matter if those numbers held significance beforehand in some other ancient culture. In the culture of the Hebrews at that time, you know, we're getting, you know, these numbers in the scripture. That's it. Like, there's a whole strain of liberal theology that, you know, tries to discredit the literal truth of the scripture by, you know, laying these things. The things that you're repeating right there, and probably what you got from our PCUSA friend, is something called 19th century Higher German criticism, okay? And there are answers to all this. You know, this all comes from something called the documentary hypothesis, where Moses didn't really write the first five books of the Bible. They were written in the post-exilic period, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, there's all of these theories out there that you can read up on, but they have all been dealt with at great length by conservative theologians.
Serendipity, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say that I think that the meaning of those numbers having that relevance is because of the way that they were used in the scripture repeatedly over and over and over again.
I mean, where does a cultural deposit come from, right? You know, like, that's the main question. And if we are to posit that a cultural deposit comes from the writings of that culture, you know, or the, or in the case of, say, Moses, the oral traditions of that culture, to say that we automatically will take these as non-literal numbers when they very well could be literal and they just simply match up to symbolism is begging the question, right? It's like, well, how do we know that they're not, you know, how do we know that they are
right? So that's a very fair response. But the flip side of it is, why treat them with absolute certainty that they are literal, right? So, like, does it matter if it was 40 years or 37 years or 48 years and 2 months? Does it matter?
The ACU joins the cult.
No, stop it.
It does matter because...
Why does it matter?
Because when the author posits these numbers as literal and not just around 40 years or, you know, because they could use... There's ballparks in the scripture, you know, all over the place, you know, but like the numbers that are meant literally are to be taken literally because the author means for you to take them literally. It doesn't matter what whatever theologian says. What matters is what did the author say? And the project of biblical hermeneutics is always to get what the original intent of the author is. And you know, postmodernism, one of the tenets of postmodernism is that you cannot divine the original intent of any author under any circumstance. And that is the project of 19th century criticism. It was a proto form of it was a proto Gnostic form of postmodernism.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, forgetting the 19th century critique again, and this is the last thing I'll say on it, is that if the cultural understanding of that time is that what these numbers meant, and the people were writing it at this time, it is logical to consider that maybe they were writing it within that context, and that whether it was, I mean, like, is it a thing where they literally counted the calendar days to the exact, I mean, maybe they did, right? But like, is it possible they didn't literally count the calendar days in exact for, you know, the 40 years? And it was a long time, and they denoted 40 because in their cultural context, that means a very long time.
Right, again.
That's where you get to, are they counting or is the Holy Spirit counting?
Right, and again, it gets to, like, why do we have to say that they're not literal numbers? You know, what is the purpose of that? So if you ask yourself, well, what is the purpose of just saying, well, these are the cultural numbers, they're not literal numbers? Well, the purpose of that is to cast doubt and to cast aspersion on the integrity of the scripture, that we're just making numbers up that are going to match our narrative. That is the purpose of that.
I don't think that's the purpose of, I mean,
oh,
okay,
it's 100% the purpose from those people. Trust me.
Yeah, I was going to say, let me reframe. I don't think that's the purpose of everybody who would look at this question. I think
it
you could look
literally
at it.
Is.
I think, no, it isn't. You can look
well, see,
at
he was
it,
looking but, at the question, and his motive probably isn't to destroy Christianity.
Yeah,
sure.
It's not.
His isn't, but, like, but again, the people, the academics and theologians that do this do have, I mean, come on, you know, everybody has an axe to grind. Everybody has some kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's got an angle. Everybody's got some kind of thing. There's an ulterior motive to almost everything. And so when we ask ourselves, like, why are we questioning, you know, whether or not these numbers are true? And what it comes down to is there's a sexual sin that I really like and I'm not giving it up. And that's what almost all liberal theology comes down to.
Look, Chris, just say goodbye to Bob. Oh.
What?
Thought you're confessing.
I think we need to hear Tony's views on the matter. He stays awful quiet. I think we need to I think he needs to weigh in on this one.
Chris, I was just joking, Chris. Did you get the joke?
I didn't get the joke. I thought you were talking about Bob, like if Bob was
you
in the
said
audience.
It was,
and I looked in the audience.
Well, no,
and it was
I meant Bob to just be like a stand-in gay male you had a thing for, but then I'm like, oh, he probably thinks I mean that Bob.
That's, no, because yeah, you're like, that's exactly where my head went. I thought you meant that Bob, and I was like, what are you talking
But then
about?
I thought, I'm just going to let it go because that's even funnier. But it's like, you know, when you're like, there's a sexual thing you don't want to give up, and instead of you meaning these people, I was like being like, you meaning Chris is confessing, haha. All right, that's
if
why
you
I don't
to
do comedy.
Explain
people.
A joke,
why
it probably isn't real funny.
That's why I don't do comedy. I try, but all right, just gotta. Come on, someone watching this CEO is gonna think it was like, funny. They're gonna get it and think it was funny.
CEO might like this other time.
I thought it was Bob. I thought you were talking about Bob too. To Chris's yeah, point, real Bob. Right? Yeah,
but it's interchangeable. That works. Like, I mean, that could be taken as Chris is confessing as, you know, sinful desire for that Bob.
You're still trying to explain a joke.
Oh, just
cut it out.
Tell someone to read a book.
Nate, can you get Bob and the Indian guy doctor together in the same room one day with us? I think that would just be amazing. And a Hebrew Israelite. Can you
and
have like all three on stage?
We need the King of Atlantis back.
Just won't ever stop talking. Like, just any of them. Doesn't matter. Like, pick a Hebrew Israelite. They will never stop talking.
That's pretty true. So did you see the thing on Protestia about the Women of Color Study Bible?
No, but Steph shared a link from Babylon Bee about the Trump Bible. Like, in his vernacular.
Yeah. Children of Israel were bad. I can't do a good Trump.
What about the Women of Color Study Bible? Do you got one yet?
I mean, yeah, I'm going to pick one up, man. I mean, the cover's wild, but like...
can we see the cover? Do you have a link?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say this isn't like a Bible. Like,
okay.
That's a complete good translation. It just happens to be for women of color. I'm imagining it's like...
So he's going to stay home, I guess.
Is your wife beating you right now? Is that what's going on?
What if Bibles were written in accents?
Have you seen the pigeon Bibles? And there's a pirate
they
Bible.
Have their, hold up. Pigeons have their own Bibles? What does it say?
Not the bird
I don't
pigeon.
Understand that. Oh.
Steph can explain if she ever joins. But no, it's like, you know, the culture, like Cajun, almost. Like oh, protesti. Oh. Chris put a link to the Women of Color Study Bible. If you want to click that in chat.
Oh, it's a hoot.
All right, let's check this out.
So, there's a hip hop Bible, Nate.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. Oh, my gosh, Chris, are you really buying this?
I mean, I wasn't gonna, but, you know, I could.
I mean, it's a King James version, so, I mean... Do they edit it or just have artwork, I wonder?
Well, it's a study. You know what a study Bible is. It has, like, all these notes. Like, so it'll have, like,
oh,
notes
so all
the
notes
bottom.
Are going to be... Okay, so all the notes are going to be geared... Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah. So, like... So one of the pictures is the Book of John. It gives, like, a little, like, you know, synopsis for each, you know, each book or whatever. In the Book of John, it says, there are no women in this book. Because there's women of color. So, like, there's just no women in the book. I mean, there's just, you know, because, of course, there's Mary and there's the woman at the well and there's, you know, Mary Magdalene and there's a ton of women in the Book of John. But, you know, there's no women in this book. It's like, it's brutal. It's wild.
Wow. Do they have a male version? I think that's the Hebrew Israelite Bible.
Kyoto wants.
But what the people of that time would have looked like today's Lebanese people or something, though, right? Isn't that what they would have looked like?
Yeah, most likely. I mean, that could be a whole mix of things. I mean, sub-Saharan Africa is probably not, you know, well represented, but could be. I don't know.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah, that's a hoot. and maybe the Provisionist Bible will come out. That'll be good.
It'd be real short, though. It'd be only like John 3:16.
Is there a Calvinist Bible?
Yeah, it's just called the Bible.
Yeah. So, funny story.
Okay, so I guess we've exhausted everything.
Well, yeah, I'm just going to tell a funny story until someone has something godly. So, I have this friend, and he's dating women. Anyway, so one of his dates is an artist. I guess she's like a pretty, like, I don't know if it's a hobby or her actual job, but she's, I guess, like a pretty serious artist. So, for their dates, she's been wanting him to, like, you know, go to the art store and buy supplies, to which, like, apparently on like date number one, she just goes and starts like throwing crap in the basket, and it comes up to like, you know, a couple, like $100 and something of stuff. And, you know, he just pays for it. And then they go start painting these canvases. So over their dating adventures, they made a couple of different paintings. So there was a dispute on one painting because she wanted to use it in a gallery, but he's like, well, I really like this. Like, this is something that I did that actually turned out decent. Like, I'd really like to, you know, put this in my house. And then he's like, not to mention, I bought all the stuff. I don't think he told her that. But anyways, then their date kind of turned, I think, sour. And, you know, they decided they're not going to see each other anymore. So he's like, what do I do? Like, I really want that painting. He's like, you know, I could even offer to pay for it. And I'm like, no, dude, no. I'm like, just set up. He's like, well, do I want to, what if I just ask her for it? I'm like, well, no, because if it's really not on good terms, like, I don't know how bad she hates you, but if it's not on good terms and you ask her for it, then she'll know what's coming. I'm like, you need to like ask for one more date. Just be like, hey, let me just bring over some takeout, you know, in this thing good, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then like when she like goes to the restroom or the other room or something, just grab that painting and run. Anyway, so,
Nate.
Anyway, he just texted
sometimes
me, and
you have
I don't
the
know.
Worst advice.
But he just texted me, and I haven't read it yet, so I don't know the outcome. He just said, "Oh, my dating life." So I'll have to find out later, like what happened. But so I mean, you know, on one hand, it may not be godly advice, but on the other hand, it's kind of joking too. So I'm not necessarily saying definitely do this. It's kind of like you should do this, ha ha. But then also, I mean, he pretty much paid for everything anyway. So I mean. Is it not more his than hers?
Why did she end up with the painting in the first place? If he painted
it. I guess
it?
they painted it at her house.
It's weird.
Well, they both painted it. It's like one of the things like, you know, couples paintings. So like they both had a part creating it. But it happened at her house. So it's
so
currently
wait, so she painted it and he painted on it as well on the same canvas.
Yeah, it's like one of those stupid dating things where it's like, oh, you paint this and I'll paint that and we love each other. Like, you know, a couples painting type thing. So, yeah, they both had a hand in creating it, but it was at her house. So that's
this
why
just sounds, this just sounds incredibly painful from somebody like that has done art. Like, this just sounds, this literally sounds like the worst way to spend an afternoon.
That's what I said.
I actually kind of want to hear from Steph on this one.
Steph, you have thoughts? Yeah, you guys are artists. Like, what would you think? Like, you know, you okay, so you guys are the true artists, and you're dating someone before you're happily married with kids, but back in your days when you're true artists, and the person you're dating
wait, after you
just
get
wants
married,
to do
you
a,
stop being an artist?
Well, it's the dating thing. I'm trying to save your marriage. You're dating people going. Because you're not married yet. Okay, so you're a true artist in your heyday dating people. It's the idea of it doesn't matter. You both came up with it together. Let's have couples date night and, you know, do a painting together. So these other people, you're dating people who are not serious artists. They just think they're doing it for a fun activity because I don't know why not. So the result is you're like, oh, that was fun. That was blah, blah, blah. That was a good date. But then on one of the paintings, your date, who's not a serious artist, says, hey, I really like what I did there. You know, do you mind if I have this painting? What would you think? Oh, and you also then have a bitter breakup and never want to see them. But you're like, well, I painted it too, and I'm the real artist, and it looks good. I could use this at a gallery. I could, you know, monetize this. I could do something. And they're just going to, like, you know, hang it up on their shelf or something.
I mean, I'm going with her on this one.
Well, her is not speaking.
Why didn't he just take a picture of it, get the picture printed off, and put it on a frame and put that on his shelf? I mean, come on, that's too much fighting and too much arguing over a painting. I mean, come on, it's just a piece of canvas.
Yeah, painting's stupid. Oh, is she answering in? Oh, she's answering in chat. Collaborative pieces are common, though, and then both artists get credit. Well, yeah, I mean, regardless of which artist gets credit, which artist gets the painting? I think Steph would just be like, let them take it, because she's a nice person.
Oh, my goodness. All right, bring her up to speed. All right.
Okay, I have a friend who's dating, and this girl he's dating is, like, I guess an artist. Like, she has a gallery and showings and stuff. Whatever. Anyway, so... They start dating, and one of them, I don't know which one, if it matters, I don't know which one, suggests that they do this artist painting together. So they go to the craft shop for like a date activity. So they go to the craft shop, she starts throwing crap in baskets, and he basically pays for all the materials. They go home, they create several paintings together, for like a fun date activity. But one of the paintings he feels he did a really good job on, he's like, well, hey, I really kind of like this. And they were kind of, and she's like, well, yeah, but you know, I did it and I can use it and blah, 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 and whatever. And he's like, yeah, but I did good. Like, I'm kind of proud of, you know, how it turned out. I like it. And then they decide not to see each other anymore for just other reasons. So the result is they're not going to continue dating. And this art, particularly the one this guy really wanted because he felt like he did good, is still at her house because that's where they created this thing. The one answer is, you know, who should get it? But then my recommendation, which you can weigh in on, was I half-hearted jokingly, not giving good Christian advice or any advice, I jokingly said, he's like, well, should I just text her and be like, hey, I really want this painting? I'm like, no, because then if she doesn't want to, you're never going to get in her house again. I'm like, what you should do is, you know, go to her house, be like, hey, let's just talk one more time. Let's hang out a little bit. And then, you know, we'll just, you know, go our separate ways or whatever. And then when she excuses herself to go in the other room or something like that, grab that painting and run. Anyway, but yeah, so who should get the painting?
Well, okay, she's saying I have so many questions about this person, but she's saying she's a professional artist and she makes money at galleries. Is that the story?
So, yes. So apparently this guy says she does have gallery showings, but not
showings, or she's represented by a gallery and makes money.
I'm about to explain. So not gallery, like you would think, and like professional, like New York City, like, you know, all like super whatever. But gallery that she rents, like, you know, the like local town's rec room and puts up a bunch of her crap for sale.
Yeah. I mean, I could tell by Let's Paint for a Date Night. That's just okay. Anyway.
So not what you city folk would call whatever.
With but she does have a $20,000 art degree.
Yeah, but she basically puts up a bunch of paintings and, you know, has price tags and people in the small city come watch.
Here's what he can leverage is that she can never use it for anything. She can't sell it. She can't make money on it. She can't show it. She needs his permission. He's a collaborator. It doesn't matter. Like, even if she was freaking Mondrian and has a name and a professional, she couldn't do anything with that painting because it's a collaborative piece. So I guess she can just keep it and look at it. But she's going to need his permission to do anything with it. So
if she just wanted to keep it and look at it, and that's all he wants to do too, which one should get it?
They should have visitation rights and a custody battle.
Or, like everything else in the art world, she can just lie about it and sell it and call it a day.
Yeah, but he has provenance that he worked on it.
Steph, like, you know, she can like, just rip it in half and give half to him and half to her.
Now that's right, just like Solomon, right? Like Solomon.
That's actually not a bad idea.
Well, Steph, in your spicier days, would you have ever given into an urge to, you know, set up a guise to go, like, you know, confess your love one more time to this person, and then just, like, once you're in their house, just grab the painting and run?
I only have one ex-boyfriend. I can't imagine doing that, no.
Oh, Steph.
But Chad and I have done collaborative pieces because we're both painters, you know. We've done collaborations. So if I mean, we're married, so what's mine is, you know, his and vice versa. But it's like, if we showed that, both of our names would need to be on it. That's just how that works. If she's renting space, she just can't sell it. She can't do anything with that thing.
Yeah, I don't think the question is about her doing anything with it. I think it's just that she wants it and he wants it.
You know what he could do? Here's an actual other solution. He can go take it to a print shop who can take a very high resolution scan and do a Gliclay print. And that's going to be like a textured print. I mean, an artist can tell the difference, but he could get a pretty, if he goes to a good shop that's got good color matching ability, he can get a really decent print of that and then just let her keep the original. Okay, so if he goes to a print shop and he gets it, he has to bring it. They should be able to scan it, and they'll do something called a Gliclay. Kevin, is that the way you said it? Gliclee. It's a textured print on canvas. And it would, I mean, if he's not a professional, that would make a nice enough duplicate.
Do you think it would be enough of a duplicate that if she's not a real artist, he could just like put both prints and be like, here, pick one. If you're a real artist, you'll know the real one.
I mean, because Gliclays will sort of like imitate texture, but they don't match brush strokes. So yes, if she'll be able to tell. But she might not. I don't know if you could try it.
Thank you for your help, you art people.
You are welcome.
I haven't either. I'll ask for a picture. I'll make it my PTR. Give me a yes.
So, is what I'm about to ask you guys really true? So I found out today in another room before your guys' room. I just popped into a room with some friends and stuff, and they were talking. Do people really get on this app and find like girlfriends and boyfriends and move like states?
They sure try.
States closer or closer to one another, and then like why?
I've seen it happen. Some people which I learned recently. I used to be on Google whenever they first came out with this whole religious fighting stuff, and these two Christian people I knew, and Chris knows them. I guess after like we stopped hanging out on Google because you know they destroyed their own platform. But I didn't hear anything from them, and I guess these two people kept in contact, and ended up getting married. So like a few months ago, I found out. I'm like, oh, that person's still around. I'm like, oh, they're still around. They're like, yeah, they're married. I'm like, what? I'm like, oh my gosh. So yes, apparently, love happens, and they are strong in their Christian faith.
Is that how Jimmy met his wife? Was online?
Yeah, they used to be in my podcast on Google back in the day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a crazy thing.
They never mentioned that to me. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I guess I never asked.
Because they think you're a weird stranger.
I mean, here's the thing, right,
Adam? I never talk to him anymore. Huh?
Adam, how long have you been married?
Many, many moons have come and gone in my lifespan of marriage.
The dating right now is horrifying. When I look at, like, my brother went through a divorce 2 years ago, and so now he's dating. And it looks horrific. And I have single friends. I cannot imagine being out there dating. So the idea of meeting someone on Clubhouse, falling in love, and then moving. Like, people are using Tinder and crazy apps. And, like, Clubhouse is the least horrifying of the things that I've heard. Like, right now, my brother is dating six girls that all know about each other and are dating, like, six other guys. It's disgusting.
Oh, you realize Chris is on this app, right? And you said it's the least horrifying. Oh, hi, Chris.
Yeah, well, I think that's like the least horrible.
Yeah.
Well, like I'm wondering. She swiped left. But I was trying to wonder. I'm like, okay, wait. How can we imagine this without like my wife killing me and be like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, no. Imagining like you got struck by lightning or something. Like, what would I do to date right now? Or how would I give advice to people who are trying to date right now? And I'm like, okay, well, you know. The real answer is, I don't know, just sign up for a bunch of dating apps. But the godly answer, right, because God first, so, you know, assuming we're trying to go in the order of importance, which we should, I'm like, so, and it's like when you know the right thing, but you don't always do the right thing, it's like, I'm almost sure the right thing to do is just go straight to where at least there's a guise of people wanting to put Christianity or religion first. So, you know, go sign up for like Christian Mingle or like some of the Christian dating apps, because you know, maybe join like a couple like different area church like singles groups or go to a couple events, even though it's probably a waste of time. Basically, stick your toe in that water, get it on a couple dates, and be like, okay, look, first things, and just give them like the kind of purity test Chris would give about religion, except maybe not so repulsive. But, you know, be really hard. Be like, look, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Because it's not enough just to be like, oh, are you a Christian? Because most people are going to be like, sure, I'm a Christian. And you're like, what does that mean? And it's like, well, you know, we always go to church on New Year's. And it's like, oh, divorce is fine. It's like, wait, so, you know, grill them about and be like, okay, look, I don't want to weird you out, but this is important to me. So before we go further, I just want to make sure we're good on the big things. And if you're not, well, then let's not waste our time, which is probably a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're that on the nose about it. They're like, wow, you're creepy. You're a Puritan, blah, 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 which may be fine. But if it's, I don't know. So where do you stand? I'd be like, well, okay, look, I got you on a Christian website. This is the most important thing because, you know, in 100 years, we're going to be dead. And where do you spend eternity? So what do you think about these things, like a top 10 of Christian questions? And be like, great. Now let's move on to, like, I don't know, entertainment or other stuff. I'm pretty sure that's the right way to do it.
So you wouldn't be like Elvis, you know, and be.
Oh, he got a call. I mean, I probably wouldn't start with, hey, do you like tacos or hamburgers better? Hey, do you like Coke or Dr. Pepper better? I'd be like, is Jesus God? I'd be like, do you deny the Trinity? What do you think about divorce? Because, you know, they say people divorce Christians about 50%, just like everyone else. I'd be like, is divorce an option short of, like, you know, fear for your life or something like that?
I mean, when we were in college, I straight up told my husband, who was an atheist at the time, we weren't even dating then. I said that I didn't date unless I thought I could marry the person, and that it was going to be, if he didn't believe in marriage, if he wasn't going to be a Christian, it was an utter waste of time. Just like, no, I'd rather be alone. And I literally, like, I saw enough sort of like unequally yoked marriages in my life where the person lost their faith. You know, that's just the way that goes. Not worth it. Rather be alone in a cave with chickens. Thank you.
It is easier for people to pull. It's easier for people to pull someone down than for them to lift someone up. Not saying it can't happen, but I mean, that's usually the way it goes. And not to offend you, Michael, but I guess I am saying atheism is pulling down rather than lifting up.
Yeah, no, you're so, totally fine. No.
Welcome, Michael.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I mean, so my wife and I, we've been married for 18 years, been together for 20. And we met online, you know, the old fashioned way. And it's, what's interesting is, there are a lot of parallels, right? Because it was clear in my profile, on the, I don't even know if the dating site that I use still exists anymore, but,
what was it?
It was called Lava Life.
Oh.
But it was clear in my dating profile that I was an atheist, and it did help to kind of thin things out, right? Like basically, like what you said, you know, like don't waste my time, right? If your Sunday mornings are spent in church, have a nice day, find somebody else. And it did help, you know, to cull the herd, so to speak. and I think it works, but partially from my perspective, it was, you know, I guess, in some ways similar to you, you know, life is short and it's silly to not spend your life as much of as your life as possible, being as happy as you possibly can be and be with the person, you know, be with the person you want to be with. And so I think when it comes to dating, sorting those things out is smart. You know, like why waste your, like, I think what Steph said is 1,000% online. Like, why waste your time with someone if you're not trying to move forward? I don't personally understand that. I know lots of people who just date casually and they like that kind of thing. It never computed for me. It didn't make any sense to me, but to each their own.
And right, see, then so, it's like except then it's how to present that to people though, right? Because that, like, that's what I want on a checklist. But if I went out with a date with a girl and she did what we're talking about to me, even though I would agree, and I'm like, that's exactly the best way to do it. But she's like, okay, do you believe in our Lord Jesus? Do you believe this? I'm like, okay, whoa, what's with this test? even though I actually think that way and that's what I want, it's like, still, if someone comes with like that energy, like, even though they're just trying to like thin the herd quickly to not waste time, it's like, if you approach it exactly that way, like, you've got to find like a gentler way to work that in. Otherwise, you're just going to think you're crazy and run. So it's like, how best to do that? Chris, were you saying something? Was that you?
No, I oh, was. So here's one of my more controversial takes that may cause Serendipity D and Steph to have an aneurysm. So when I decided to begin practicing abstinence in 2004, I ended up making the decision to never have a girlfriend again. And the reason for it was that the idea of a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship has a 99% failure rate if you do the math. And it's not like a real commitment. It's like a very fake one. So I decided that, like, when I met somebody and just had built enough of a relationship with them where I felt like I could make a real commitment, I would just propose. And that's how I ended up getting married. So I stopped doing the girlfriend thing and skipped straight to proposal.
Wait, so how did you...
Beautiful.
How did you meet someone to propose to? You were like friends, propose? Like
that? Yes, yeah, two years. Yeah, 2 years of friendship. And like, okay, sure, we kissed, but there was not like a... there was not a expectation. There was not like, you know, exclusivity, etc., right? It was basically the moment I felt so compelled that I had to be with this person, I just proposed.
So, like, friends with no benefits, and then marriage.
Correct.
I'm dead.
Well, D, what do you think, D?
I think this.
We'll get to you in a second. I think D, but I was going to say, Kevin, if you could change your name to Warren, that'd be a lot awesomer. But, yeah, D, and then we'll get to Kevin. What's up, D?
I think it's beautiful. You guys, I am back from Dubai.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, she lived.
Listen, it was amazing. Like, it was, I honestly think, because they, you know, they practice Sharia law, but it's Sharia law with international law put together. It was clean. There were no bombs on the street. It was like, what'd you say?
Because I killed them all.
No, they actually take care of homeless people. Like, they, you know, provide housing for homeless and everything.
She got
like
indoctrinated
that.
And brainwashed.
Are you a Muslim, Dee? Are you a Muslim?
I'm not saying I'm a Muslim, right. But I was thinking we might need some. Listen, like, if there are any, like, gay communities around, there are none to be found. That it is not, you can't, no public affection. Like, it's everything that we Christians would love for America to be, and that is not. It's like, I was just so amazed.
The low price of killing everyone who disagrees with you.
It's just a problem about
that. So wait, not what happened.
No, why do we because keep no, wait, this? Wait, wait. It's not like that because, again, they have international law with Sharia law. This is Dubai, so this is not. I'm not speaking on behalf like of, you know, Saudi Arabia. No, this is not what I'm saying, but. It was beautiful. And the only people that I had problems with were Indian women because they were rude. Indian women will bump you and not say, excuse me. But outside of that.
Did you bump them back?
Yes. I got to the place that I realized that you have to bump them back. Like, that's the culture. So,
yes. Did you say, like, the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you always?
No, I didn't have to do all. And, like, they really didn't speak on religion. It wasn't, you know, unless you went to the mosque. Outside of that, there was no, like, you don't hear a lot of, and the prophet this and the prophet that, you don't hear that a lot. And the majority of people there were Indian. Yes, they were Indian. So it was like a few, like, you could only see a few people who were of Arab descent, but most of them were Indian. So it was a really good experience. And like the way they paint out Sharia law in Dubai is it's nothing like that at all. And you can wear whatever you want. So there is that too.
I am not sold. This woman got kidnapped and brainwashed.
Yeah. We read you the travel rules. What do you mean you can wear whatever you want? You're supposed to.
Well, I'm just saying, like, let me say this. The first two days, I was like making sure everything was covered. And I just saw the people there and they had half tops on and this and that. And yeah, it was, you could, you know, you can wear shorts. You could, it was like people who dress in America. It was, well, it was very back. Americanized. It was not like, I felt like I was in a city in America.
It's Miami. It's Arab Miami.
It was, no, I mean, it's more like Vegas. It's more like Vegas, yeah, but cleaner. It's a clean Vegas.
If you felt, yeah, I was going to say, if you felt like you're in a city in America, there should be people pooping on the street. Oh, by the way, Steph, do you like that? The San Francisco, like, apparently Newsom asked Californians to come up with a new logos for their some commemorative coin he wanted. And it was hilarious. People were, like, using AI to design, like, new coins with, like, tents on the street and, like, poop on the street. And, like, it was so funny.
The one that had, like, the Golden Gate Bridge with just the poop swirl on it, that was my favorite one.
Oh, it's like San Francisco, the only city where, like, dogs have to worry about stepping in human poop. Okay, Kevin, you were going to tell us about something. What's up, Kevin?
Not much. I mean, I was going to comment on CEO's dating angle there, and I thought it was really good. But you guys start talking about Dubai and homeless people pooping in San Francisco. I have nothing else to say.
Go back to the dating
thing. No, I want to hear the dating thing.
No, I just think that what he did, it was a good transition, right? I think it was really wise. So instead of, like, blurring the line and kind of making, well, not blurring the line, but making this definite border to say, oh, now let's approach it in this way, he liked the friendship angle that it was already on and just rode that through. I think what a lot of people do when they change the relationship a bit and try to make it, oh, now we're husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend instead of friends anymore, that kind of ruins the whole taste of what it is. So he kind of just said, hey, let's just keep it the way it is. In addition to that, we're married. That's it. I thought it was pretty smart.
Did you feel different after you got married, Kevin?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. I always ask people that question, and I'm surprised more people say no than I would have expected.
I felt different too once I got married too. It was like, this is right. Yeah, this is right. That's what
I think my wife
felt
different. She's like, what have I done? Like, you're stuck.
I was going to comment on that before, Nate, that you cannot tell your wife. This is like the what did you say, the wispy hair thing? You cannot tell your wife that you're talking about dating because, like, what if she got hit by lightning? Listen, if your wife got hit by lightning, you are mourning in sackcloth and ashes for the rest of your days. You would never be the same again. Women don't exist to you. That's the right answer, just so you know.
Well, that is probably the right answer, but it's not the biblical answer, right? Like, hey, wife, see, that's going to be one of the questions. I'm like, hey, wife, look, do you care about your emotional feels or what the Bible says? Because the Bible says, you're dead, I'm free. But, right, that's all one right. of the things.
That I would want my husband to get married again because I wouldn't want him to be out here fornicating. So I would want him to get married again. And I have three daughters, so I know he would need some type of assistance with my daughters.
Well, not fornication, but what about the sackcloth and ashes mourning your death for the rest of time?
Oh,
well,
goodness.
I feel like, you know, when you absent from the body, you're with, you know, you're with the Most High. So, like, let's celebrate. Like, I lost a child. So, like, I have to look at it as this was our Heavenly Father's plan. And he's now with, you know, our Heavenly Father, absent from the body, present with him. So I don't try to be sad about it. You know, outside of
me. Yeah, I'm trying to set my kids' mind right. They're like, you know, whenever they're like, so you mean you'll die someday? I'm like, yep, we're all going to die. They're like, well, what if we die first? What if this happens? I'm like, 100 years, you're all dead. Everyone you love, all dead. Like, just get to heaven. That's it. They're like, well, won't you be sad? I'm like, everyone's sad. Life is pain. Just get to heaven.
Yo,
like, do you have any other questions? They're like, no, Daddy.
I have like five new gray hairs growing in all in one spot, which is quite fortunate. But, you know, I'm 35 and get my first gray hairs. And my 8-year-old yesterday was sitting next to me and the light was right and she caught the hairs and she goes, Mom, you have gray hair. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. It's coming in, right? I kind of like it. And she's like, no, that means you're really close to death. And I'm just like, okay, thanks, babe.
Like, you're really close to being adopted.
Wow.
Exactly.
There's an MXPX song about that. What was it? It's like one. Some say you're one step closer to death. Others say you're one step closer to life. it was worded more catchy than I did. But right, that's a Christian outlook, right? It's like, oh, what is, I gotta hear that song again now to remember how it went. It's like, one step closer to death, but I say you're one step closer to life. Yeah.
I mean, my grandpa, in our family culture, on my dad's side, death is like, hooray, you've made it. Like, have you guys heard Connie talk about how she's almost at the end of her race? And she's always, like, so happy about it. And so that's how my grandfather was. So he, like, had his gravestone done. I mean, he, you know, he just didn't want my grandma to have to worry about anything. So he had everything done, everything prepared for, and he was just, like, so excited. I remember he took all the kids to the gravestone to look at it. And he's like, I'm going to be with Jesus soon. And he, like, walked us through this whole thing about how death is such a good thing. And, yeah, I don't know. That was my experience pretty young.
Well, people may think it's a bleak outlook, but it's – well, yeah, people think it's maybe a bleak outlook. They're like, well, maybe when you've lived your life and you're, like, 80 and 90, then you kind of look forward to eternity. I'm like, dude, I'm, like, barely 42. Am I 42? I'm 41. I'm like, I'm 41, but I've already been looking forward to it for a while. Like, let me go.
Yeah, my wife has that mentality now. She has that mentality.
I mean, I think that's also a thing too, right? Because the more successful and more rich you are, which, you know, like the Bible says, you know, rich people, you know, makes it difficult, right? To, like, live out the Christian life because you're, like, carried away with thoughts of, like, the more you have, the more you try to grasp onto, but you can't. You can't take it with you. Versus, like, you know, the poor beggar people in the Bible that, like, you know, they give all you have because it's like, well, you know, I have like a copper whatever. Like, it's not enough to buy food anyway, so it's very easy to just give it all away. Versus people that can buy plenty of food, they're like, oh, but it's mine, it's harder. And it's also like, well, you know, this world is pain. Like, who cares? Let's go. Versus people like, no, I have so much, I'm so successful, I have to become a transhumanist and, you know, put my brain in a vat and sail through the ages of time and
Yeah, that pretty much describes us. Like I'm looking forward to the future because I like the innovation of things, but I'm kind of adopting her mindset. She doesn't like this world at all, and it started ever since we had kids. Because ever since we had kids, the love that we have for our kids came along with that was the fear of losing them, right? And then looking at this entire world, like, she cannot watch the news. Like, especially when those school shootings were happening, and she has a big heart for children. She's just sick and tired of everything that's being, you know, said in the headline. So she doesn't watch the news. She doesn't read a newspaper. She doesn't really look at a whole lot. You know, at most, you know, she looks at, like, celebrity deaths and things of that nature and whatnot. But, like, just the news in general and stuff, it leaves a very bad taste in her mouth. And she just wished this will stop and that Christ will come back. So she doesn't want to die, but she's not afraid of death because she, like her mother, just want to go to glory, you know? So, I mean, I understand it, but.
Yeah. Michael, what are your thoughts when your time is nigh? Are you just like, yeah, I look forward to a dirt nap? Or no, I have to live past the singularity where I can, you know, continue existing forever as a robot human? Or are you just like, nah?
I can't remember where I read this, but basically, nobody gets out of this life alive. and I think that's very true.
That's from Van Wilder.
I don't remember where I heard it, but it's like, it's interesting. So I agree with some of what Kevin said just a minute ago, right? But with a different twist, right? So because I am convinced that this is it, like, this is not a dress rehearsal for eternity. I want to suck the marrow out of this life. I want to live as good a life as I can for as long as I possibly can. This is what he said that I agree with. I am not afraid of death. I think the most thing is that I'm not thrilled about what the dying process could be, but I'm not afraid of being dead. Like, that doesn't, because I'll be as conscious as I was before I was alive. So that doesn't scare me at all. But I do want, because I know, or I'm convinced that this is it, I want to get as much as I can. And I have no reason to die. I have every reason to try to live as long as I possibly can.
Well, see,
but yeah.
Well, that's kind of why I asked you, because I mean, that, I think that reasoning is kind of going away, and especially like, you know, as the years pass, that reasoning is rapidly going away, because now, I mean, it was common. The kind of atheist rebuttal would be like, oh, well, you know, Christians think you have an eternal fairy paradise place to go to. It's like, well, we are the, usually it's for like moral superiority or something. It's like, we know this life is all we have, and that's why we want to make this planet the best it can be. I'm like, well, so do we, jerk. Anyway, but I think that reasoning is gone because now people are really pushing towards like transhumanism and like life extension technologies and continued living. So that's why I was kind of asking you that, like, would you be focused on that and to what degree? Or like, I don't care about any of that. When my life is naturally time to go, then just send me on my way. Or would you be like really striving to achieve some way to like carry on your consciousness or something like that?
I honestly haven't given that a lot of thought. Is there, but I very specifically, I don't want to live forever. Because I think it would be boring. And that's just my personal thought. Like, I have no desire to live forever. I remember hearing someone, you know, it was, you're aware of, Aaron Ra. He said this once in a discussion I saw with him. He said, all I want to do is live a good life and then die. And I think there's value in that. And I think there's, I think that's why I look at this life as being so precious, right? And do I want to try to leave a better world behind for the next generation? Yes. And Nate, while you said, so do we, jerk, not everybody does. Like, there are lots of people who are like, let it burn. It doesn't matter because Jesus is coming back. I have spoken with people that have that very sentiment, that it doesn't matter what we do to the earth. Now, I am not saying that that's on you, but I'm saying I have spoken to people that have said, it doesn't matter what we do, Jesus is going to fix it. Well, I think it's a little, maybe just a little bit short-sighted on their point. And because I'm convinced that's not the case, I think they're leaving behind perhaps a pretty bad legacy and perhaps not much of a planet to inhabit. Another way to look at this is it doesn't matter. Because in 4-ish billion years, the sun will swell and Earth is gone, right? Like, you know, I mean, like, that is just, we know from other celestial bodies, that's what's going to happen. We have seen other stars like ours do the same thing. So that's just kind of what's going to happen. And, anyway, so go ahead.
You said a whole lot. I'm trying to just like remember everything. Okay, so one, you would have to admit, and of course you do, there are atheists who think that this life is all they have, who most certainly are not trying to make the most of the evil either. So they're not good moral people like you say you are. They're straight up evil people who are just, you know, committing crimes left and right. So they don't care about the earth and leaving either. Also, yeah, I've heard people say that, like, you know, God, doesn't matter, God's in control, let this place burn. But typically, those are not oil tycoons who are sucking oil and, you know, doing all this other stuff either. That may be their mindset, but those typically, the people you're talking to in Clubhouse, are not the Christians in control to do anything really bad to the earth. They may just be kind of a selfish person. Also, as far as, yeah, in 4 billion years, I think the goal of the transhumanists is to get enough technology to exist outside of the solar system or in some other black hole dimension or something, from hearing them talk. So, you know, that wouldn't matter. They have 4 billion years to figure it out. When people say, well, no, I don't want to live forever, I get bored. Okay, well, if you just live forever and nothing's going to kill you, there's no way to test that unless it happens. But I'm just going to say you're probably not just going to pull the plug on yourself. Like, okay, I'm bored. Do you want to die? Well, I don't want to die, but, you know, I'm tired of living 10 billion years. Okay, 10 billion years in one day. Are you bored yet? Oh, yeah, I'm bored. Well, do you want to die? Well, not today. So, I mean, maybe at some point you'll be like, okay, pull that plug. But, I mean, I'm going to go on a limb and say if you know, Aaron Ra, peace be upon him, or, you know, you or anyone says, well, you know, I just want to live a good life, and, you know, when it's over, it's over. Unless it's enacted upon you, probably there's a lot less people going to be suicidal than they think. They're like, oh, trillion and a half years. Do you want to die? Well, I don't want to kill myself. All right. Well.
Well, yeah, but another thing to consider, right, is not just like the difference between. It's funny because I've had this similar conversations with my. I mentioned him before. My father-in-law, who's a Catholic, right? And he's 84 years old, and he's still alive, at least partially through the miracles of modern medicine. His quality of life has been decreasing over the past decade or so. And so I think quality of life has a huge impact on that as well. Do I want to be alive just to not be dead? Or do I want to be living rather than just existing? That's something that has to play a part in it as well.
So, oh, Michael, that's like your life right now, forever. Yes, CEO.
Yeah, I was just going to give Michael the scenario. Okay, so the Amazon upload show is real, and basically, when you are about to die, you can be downloaded into a metaverse, and you can be 30 years old in this metaverse, and eventually, your wife will be there one day, your kids will be there. And by the way, you can actually interact with them from the metaverse right now. Like, you can call them and interact with them. So under this scenario, and you get to continue to see how humanity advances and, you know, your loved ones get downloaded with you whenever they die, and you can interact with them from there, would you want to continue to live indefinitely under this circumstance?
Yeah, no. So one, love that show. I think it's brilliant. It got a little bit dark towards the end of the last season, but I really enjoy that show. And in that very specific scenario, no, count me out.
Well, just give him a kill switch, right? So just be like, okay, you know, you can live forever, but here's a button. So if you ever truly are like, I've had enough, hit that button. I don't know anyone that would not take that deal. Big, nope, I already know right now I don't want it, so just kill me now. I mean, you're probably like, okay, fine, let me live as long as I want, and when I'm done, I'll hit that button. I've got about 15 minutes. What else do we have? Death, I have invited you and also someone else that raised their hand. And Connie, I sent you an invite if you wanted to say anything, but yeah. Welcome, Pastor Mark. Hope you're doing well today.
Didn't y'all read Talk Everlasting in school?
Nope.
Really?
I don't know what that is.
Oh, I think there's a movie now, but it's a book about a family that lives forever, and this kid, but they have to keep it a secret, and this kid falls in love with this girl, and so he wants to convince her to also live forever, and there's this fountain of youth, and so she goes through this journey of deciding whether she wants to do it because it can't be undone, and in the end she decides not to and to live out a natural life, and she gives up her love and decides not to live forever, and the whole book is about why she did that.
Mike, I wanted to ask you a question, though. So let's say you were born in, like, the 1700s. You kind of lived through the first car. You lived through the first plane, the Wright Brothers' first flight. And now you're looking at F-16s, and you're seeing tanks, and you're seeing, like, Mustangs with 5.0 engines and having 400 horsepower and all this stuff like that. And in the future on in, do you think you will ever get bored of that, or do you think you will get bored of innovation and just speaking from, like, a secular standpoint?
No, and that's really interesting. Like, I enjoy seeing, you know, like, I remember life before the internet, right? Before video games, right? I remember having, you know, my first video game system and all the cool stuff, right? Oh, I don't know, like, talking across the planet on the devices we're using right now. All that stuff is super cool. And I'm a technology geek, right? Like, I'm always upgrading devices in the house. And my wife's like, why do we need this? I'm like, oh, but it's new and shiny. Right. I get it. But, you know, it's like, did you need a new MacBook? No, but look at that's a new color. Right. So I get it. Right. But much like the only thing I can kind of equate to in that way is I never knew any of my grandparents. They all died before I was born. I don't miss them. I don't think you can miss what you never had. So when I think about all that kind of stuff, I don't know that I could miss it because I don't have the experience of it.
Yeah, but from the factor of being boring, do you think you'll ever get bored? Like, let's say you did live forever. I mean, like,
guys, stop talking him into it. Michael wants to die. let's see what Death has to say real quick. What's up, Death?
Good morning. This question is also for Michael. I know he's like the superstar this morning. Do you have a reason to think that there isn't life after death?
Do I have a reason? Yeah, yes, I think I do. To the best of our knowledge, through neuroscience, minds and consciousness are products of material brains. And so it's my belief that when this carcass expires, everything that's Michael will cease to exist. I will not be anymore. So I don't have any good reasons to believe that anything beyond my conscious life will survive.
Okay.
Yeah, like we have tons of near death experiences, right? People talk about that kind of stuff. We have zero death experiences. Zero. 0.0. And I don't see any good reason to believe that absent a material brain, a mind can transcend.
I don't know if we would want to say that we don't have any experiences of death, because I don't think we have a clear picture of what death is.
I'm talking about, like, okay, so the story from the Bible where, who was it? Is it Lazarus that was the one that was lying stinking in the earth? Am I getting that right? Yeah. Yeah, there's no way that came back to life. Just not possible, right? Absent the supernatural. So for example, when my father died 16 years ago, I saw him 6 hours after he was dead. And there were the very tips of his fingers, the tips of his ears, and the tip of his nose were already starting to decay. Pretty gruesome sight. But, and that was 6 hours, right? We know that biologically, when the cessation of life happens, that things start to go a bad way very quickly. So that's one of the biggest reasons why I'm convinced that, you know, body's decaying, all this other stuff, and that it's very quickly a point of no return.
So you think decaying is an indication of death?
It's not a soul. Well, I said cessation of life, right? Decaying happens after that, right? And I'm talking about, a lot of time, right? Like, I'm not talking about, you know, kind of like the 3 to 5 minutes where there'll still be, you know, some type of microcurrent of electricity circulating through our bodies, stuff like that. I'm talking about a total cessation of life, stuff like that.
Michael, what about that neurosurgeon who spent like 30 minutes, like there was no brain activity, there was nothing, there were no microcurrents. This dude was gone. There's no reason. There's a couple of, I agree with you that near-death experience for 5 minutes wouldn't quite convince me, but there are some out there that are like hours.
I am totally unfamiliar with those, but I'd be curious to read any accounts of it. Like,
there's a lady
unaware.
Who went under the water in a very cold, she like fell through the ice, and because, well, supposedly the reason why they think that she survived was the cold slowed her metabolism down, but she was, her brain went without new oxygen for 45 minutes. You can Google that. It's a really well-known story.
I will do so. I'm completely unfamiliar with that. I would say that there is the one good reason you said, like extreme cold, like there's a reason why they put cadavers in fridges, right? So yeah, that could be part of it. But yeah, I'll Google 45 minute woman underwater. Try that.
Yeah,
It was due to hypothermia, right? That the whole reason that that happened was the cold slowed down her metabolism drastically. So I would simply point out that death is like a sufficient condition, or sorry, rotting is a sufficient condition of death, but it's not a necessary one. Like that woman was dead for 45 minutes effectively, but she wasn't rotting, right? So it's obviously not a necessary condition.
Right. Yeah, I just am not sure on what that
specifically means. Wait, did he just bat for the Christians? Thanks, T.
Yeah, and there's also, like, you know, there's flesh-eating disease. There's, you know, there's all kinds of things that can happen while the, you know, body's still, well, obviously not perfectly fine, but, you know, operating and not dead, where you can still see decay. Yeah, I think I'd agree.
Right. I would say death is something like the irreversible cessation of metabolistic processes in a body. I would say that's something more akin to like what we're talking about, right?
Well, keep in mind also, and then T, I want to see if you had any other thing to say or if this is why you came up. But I would also say that, remember, we're talking about the supernatural God, right? So if there's like, I have no idea off the top of my head, but I'm sure there's some claim out there that someone would say, you know, someone's been dead very long, like a couple days or something like that. So again, this is something no one can prove, but I'm sure the claim is, well, they're fine. And then before someone says like, well, metabolistic decay, or, you know, they're decaying or they're rotting or they're, you know, something like that, or rigor mortis has set in. If this God wanted to have them to have some sort of experience, come back and tell people, well, he could somehow, I believe, preserve them from decaying like we otherwise know would happen. So, you know, keep that in the mind, right? Because that's the realm we're talking about. Like, of course, biology would dispute that, but from the Christian worldview, that's totally plausible. So, just saying.
Just saying, I did place her in the chat, Donna Ribadow, and I appreciate Death bringing this up. T knows I've brought it up to him before. Super cool stuff. So, she is in the chat.
Oh, yeah.
One of the many.
Click on the link Joanna put in the chat.
One of the over 5,000 documented cases of NDEs.
What was her name again?
Donna Ribadow, and she is in the chat. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Joanna. T, did you have anything, any other question or comment or anything before I have to take off?
No, I just think that the example being cited is probably a pretty good one, right? Is the reason that we would say that she was not dead is because of the conditions of the cold slowed down her metabolism such that the cessation of metabolistic processes was not reversible. It was reversible in her case, right? They resuscitated her effectively. And so that would just be the clarification there.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, thanks. And Mark in chat, yeah, good way to end up, Pastor. He says, and this kind of gets into like Lazarus, right? People that would dispute that for Lazarus being in the tomb. They'd be like, well, see, all this stuff would have happened, and, you know, he would have this and that. He would have came back as a zombie. Well, not if the whole point was, you know, God doing a miracle so people thousands of years later can benefit. He could figure it out. So Mark says, I know someone who was dead and buried for 3 days and then came back to life, which is the whole point of Christianity and the Christian worldview. But, this is a good conversation today. See what happens when all you people jump up on stage. All right, well, happy Monday, and we'll see you later. I'm going to pig out on sushi.
Sounds good. Make sure you get some fully Philly rolls.
Yeah, going straight for the good ones. No extra rice. All right, take care, everyone. See you later.